You are listening to Radio Albion.
This is the Orthodox Nationalist. Today's date is September 21st, 2025. And this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. We have dealt with the topic we're going to deal with before. But since I've been researching it for many years, but over the last few weeks, a few things have occurred to me, and it's very important we get them out now. No, I'm not going to talk about Charlie Kirk, a guy who I had barely heard of prior to his murder, although I have to admit it's exposed the intellectual shallowness of people, even on the so-called far right of the political spectrum. I mean, this is the reason why I'm very independent. I can't be a part of anything with this sort of behavior. My favorite is the Chinese media. If you read the Chinese media, you know, the machine translations are pretty good. You know, China is such a common language worldwide. And most of the headlines are, who the hell's Charlie Kirk? Anyway, no one's going to tell me what's important. No one's going to tell me what's significant or what's worth talking about. But for right now, something that is worth talking about, something that really hasn't been dealt with in depth, is the Balkans, specifically the role of Bulgaria as the new Rome. Remember, Russia received its Orthodox heritage from Bulgaria. I mean, ultimately from the Greeks, but via Bulgaria. I mean, not a whole lot of people in old Russia, Kiev, spoke Greek. It came from places like Chernovo and Ohrid. There was a time where it, around the time of the Renaissance, where it began, Chernovo called itself the Third Rome for a very short time, as did Tver in Russia. Balkans has been made unstable. It is not inherently so. And so what we're going to deal with today, the title is Leadership in the Balkans, the Second Balkan War of 1913, and the Breaking of Bulgaria. It was just a few weeks ago we dealt with the Treaty of Berlin, 1878, that defined the Principality of Bulgaria as a vassal of the Ottoman state, which certainly hampered its economic development, and that was no accident. The purpose was to eliminate Bulgaria as the leading element of the Balkan Orthodox, a leading element that really pretty soon wasn't necessarily going to need Russian support. Still, by 1912, Bulgaria had regained its strength and all but destroyed Turkey in the Balkans. So, from the point of view of the British and the French, a more permanent solution needed, or really the Austrians as well, a more permanent solution needed to be devised to keep Bulgaria in check and the Balkan Orthodox to be leaderless. World War I derives from the desire of the British to somehow get the Germans and the Russians fighting each other, even though they had no real reason to be enemies. And the Balkans was it. But if the Balkans had an autonomous leadership, that wouldn't have been an issue at all. Now, this thesis, I don't know of anyone, I'm sure there's a few in Bulgaria, I don't know of anyone in speaking English that's ever made this argument before, but I'm going to make it now. The Ottoman Empire, of course, the Turkish Empire, was extremely large. It's an exaggeration, and I hate cliches. Falling at the sick man of Europe, let's say, first of all, its colonial possessions was in Europe, but it certainly wasn't European. They were, for the most part, white, you know, they were most part white. You know, look at your typical Turk today is not non-white, but they were foreign because they were Islamic and Jews and very alienated Greeks controlled that empire, especially at its height. As it began to fall apart, thanks to the Russians, thanks to the Bulgarians, the Western world started to worry. And it wasn't merely that Russia is going to be able to dominate not just the Balkans, but even becoming the protector of the Christians of the Middle East, but that Bulgaria is being built to a point where it may not need Russia. So even if Russia is somehow, from the point of view of the Allies, for example, at the time, even if somehow the regime was able to knock Russia out and destroy the monarchy, Bulgaria still can function autonomously and provide some of the leadership in the Balkans and still provide some of the elements of a new Rome. We dealt also, whenever that was, I think a couple of months ago, maybe now, that the Ottoman Empire was deeply in debt, and that debt was held by the British. So the British, to a great extent, was in total control of the Ottoman economy. So whoever was, even indirectly, subject to the Ottoman Empire had to comply with the same trade regime imposed by Britain on the Ottoman Empire. In other words, it imposed preferential imports of European industrial goods, which doomed the development of any local domestic production. That's what free trade meant in London. So after the unification of Eastern Rumelia, that is most of the Eastern Balkans, with the Principality of Bulgaria, the efforts of the Bulgarian political elite were directed towards becoming not just independent, but bringing themselves into a national leadership position of the Orthodox peoples of the area. And you saw favorable conditions for this in 1908. The great powers were focused on the Franco-German dispute over Morocco, and Austria-Hungary was preparing to annex Bosnia and Herzegovina. Still, making even more complicated, there was a conflict between Sultan Abdul Hamid II and the Young Turks, which was intensifying, leading to a coup and the establishment of the Young Turk government. Strikes broke out. One of them, on the Edirne-Belova Railway, which was then taken by the Bulgarians, the night of September 22nd of that year, Prime Minister of Bulgaria and the Bulgarian Prince met together. And from there, the entire Bulgarian government and Ferdinand I headed towards Tarnovo, where they declared independence, finally. They had no choice but to recognize it in 1909. Its authority and power began to rise substantially. It was in 1908, September 22nd, that the independence was declared in Tarnovo. Prince Ferdinand accepted the title of King of the Bulgarians, but then that means the rest of the Balkans also has to be dealt with. Now, there's a question that comes up. Why were the royal houses, everyone but Serbia, in the area foreign? It were mostly German. I mean, it wasn't just in Bulgaria. I mean, there were Hohenzollerns who controlled the Romanian house. Of course, Bulgaria from Sax Kohlberg. Greece from the Bavarian house of Wittelsbach. Then later on, a Danish monarchy connected to Glücksburg. Why was that the case? Well, there's some very good reasons for it. Prior to German unification, you had many, many small German states, every one of which had a royal house, every one of which had a diplomatic corps, which means after unification, you had all of these people who used to be monarchs floating around with not a whole lot to do. They had their own local duties. And so they almost acted like royal mercenaries. And it was a great way to avoid infighting amongst the noble elites locally. The king was always seen as a neutral party, who, of course, had to convert to orthodoxy. In other words, the many states of pre-unification Germany meant that there was a huge surplus of legitimate royals around. They all had contacts, and they all were first-rate, most of them were first-rate diplomats. The exception to that were the Serbs, Montenegro, of course. They elected their own starting in 1804 with the rebel movement, but that was the exception. All the German monarchs were elected by the legislatures of the Baltic nations. And that includes Bulgaria. This is why they all were foreigners. But there's no doubt in my mind that they all took their duties to their adoptive countries very seriously. And some evidence of that was the First Balkan League, aimed at the Turks. This was the issue of issues. It started even in the 1860s. Serbian Prince Mihail Obrenović, after the restoration of the Bulgarian state in 1878, Belgrade and Athens were forced to adapt their plans for a territorial expansion to it. In the 1890s, the Greeks tried to unite Greece, Serbia, Bulgaria, and Romania into alliance against the Ottomans, and essentially to partition Macedonia. Yes, other proposals from the Serbs and Greeks, rejected by the Bulgarians in 1897. Bulgaria had been through the mill, as we know now, from the treaties of Stefano to the Treaty of Berlin and what that did to Bulgaria. Again, it wasn't just that a very large Bulgarian state would be an ally to Russia, that its development was so rapid. And you'll see this in the Balkan Wars. Again, development was so rapid that it could function even in the absence of Russia. So in the early years of the 20th century, there were tensions among Bulgaria, Serbia, and Greece over the Macedonian question. Belgrade made claims to, quote, old Serbia. That's Kosovo, North Macedonia, you know, the former centers of the kingdom of Stefan Dušan. And Greece, with not just to the lands with an ethnic Greek population, like South Macedonia, Epirus, but also all of the municipalities under the care of the Patriarch of Constantinople. And propaganda began to be created to exert its influence in these various areas. September 24th, 1908 was a deadly year. It was the annexation of Bosnia to the Austrian Empire. The Balkan League was formed shortly thereafter. But under threat of military conflict with both Vienna and Berlin, Russia was forced to recognize the annexation without getting any compensation. The Russian army wasn't prepared for a war with the Central Powers, and really had no desire for a war with the Central Powers. Petersburg then created an alliance among the Balkan states that would prevent further expansion of Austria in the region, and Bulgaria had a large part in this. On February 19, 1912, Bulgaria and Serbia conducted a military alliance against the Austrians, but also against Romania and, of course, the Turks. There was a secret annex to the treaty. The two countries divided up the territorial gains from the upcoming war against the Turks. A disputed area was delineated in northwest Macedonia. The decision to who controlled it was left to the Russian emperor as the final arbitrator between Sofia and Belgrade. The Serbo-Bulgarian agreement was followed by intensive negotiations between Bulgaria and Greece. There you had British mediation, which is never a good thing. Now, within the Ottoman Empire, you had substantial persecutions of Bulgarians and Greeks, and it got worse under the Young Turks, wherever they were able to take power, even prior to their coup. Bulgaria and Greece became allies very quickly because of this. Prime Minister Ivan Geshov of Bulgaria and the Greek minister in Sofia, Dimitrios Panos, signed a treaty of alliance against Turkish occupation and their violence. So the future territorial division then was left unresolved because there were far more important issues at stake. And the Bulgarian-Montenegrin agreement was concluded. And they would receive financial aid from Bulgaria. Not at the expense of Serbia necessarily. But this was, at least in a formal sense, the Balkan League was finally formed on September 23, 1912, in an agreement with Montenegro and Serbia. So these were all unilateral contracts, negotiations. It wasn't a conference that brought this into existence, and that was a huge problem. But part of it was that Bulgaria began seeing itself, and not without good reason, that the largest, the most powerful potential leader of the area. So that's how we start this off. So, step back a little bit. Late 19th century, the Ottoman Empire was largely being artificially propped up by the British. Later on, it'll be artificially propped up by the Germans. This is nationalism at its best in the Balkans. New states were being born based on ethnic nationalism, and the church, of course, being ethnic, was right at home in this. Services were done in the local languages, which meant a lot more than just convenience. So long was on its natural ethnic territory. Of course, you had border problems remaining unresolved. That becomes an issue that even leads to war. But the Turkish issue was far more important at this point. There was concern that Bulgaria was growing too large, even after the Treaty of Berlin. Each of the Balkan states had legitimate claims against their colonial master, Turkey. Turkey was a foreign element in European society. But none at the time had the sufficient strength to achieve its goals independently. It was still the Turks were disintegrating, but still had, in an emergency, the ability to draw on substantial material and human resources, had it at its disposal. Now, the Lindan Uprising in 1903 in Bulgaria failed. War became the last resort. Bulgaria was martially inclined. The government took very powerful measures to rearm and train its army and expand it. Of course, you had to keep a connection with Russia. It was important in a war with Turkey, especially, to keep in contact with them. Tsar Ferdinand in 1911 brought together a government headed by Ivan Gershov. And that coalition, which he led, was two parties, the People's Party and the Progressive Liberal Party. Now, these names mean nothing. Parties didn't function in the same way that they did in a lot of other places. Certainly, the labels mean absolutely nothing. the fact that they call themselves progressive liberals doesn't mean that they're progressive or liberal in our sense of the term. Bulgaria was governed by the Chernobyl Constitution. And there was the National Assembly did permit secret treaties to be concluded so that the certain things are not leaked to their enemies. But by what, the second decade of the 20th century, the Entente and the Central Powers were generally formed, but not necessarily early on. You know, at this point, 1911, not ready for war with each other, nor was there any desire for Russia and Germany in particular to fight one another. That means that Bulgaria had, for the first time in some time, to show its leadership potential. And Turkey just went from bad to worse. Even within the empire, military rebellions became more frequent. The Turkish army became, even as it was, became less and less disciplined. 1911, don't forget, war between Italy and Turkey for Tripolitania and Sfinacia, which is today's in Libya. So they were distracted even by that, among other problems. The relationship between Bulgaria and Serbia is at the heart of this Balkan Union. You had lengthy negotiations ending the end of February. It was a leap year, actually, February 29th, 1912. And treaties back then had secret conventions, because treaties themselves were objects of war, and not everything could be announced to their opponents. Bulgaria already was clearly the leader of the Balkans at this point, because even with Serbian assistance, Bulgaria assumed the main burden of the future war against Turkey. Everyone knew that they were going to be the leader here. The treaty divided the empire's Balkan possessions, the Turkish empire's Balkan possessions, and Serbia recognized Bulgaria's indisputable right, the way that they had this set up, using the Strema and the Rodope mountains, just south of Sofia, going straight down into the Black Sea. Bulgaria renounced all claim to the lands north and west of the Shar Mountains. That's the mountain range that separates Serbia, North Macedonia, and Albania. I spend a lot of time, I don't like just throwing out these place names that are not exactly daily conversation. I want to give a sense as to where they are. I did the same thing with the despotate in Serbia. There's so many of these towns and regions. Sometimes their names have changed today. But to give some sense as to where they are and why they're important is very, very significant. I do that. At least I try to do that. There was a disputed zone in northwestern Macedonia. And as we heard, Russia will act as the arbitrator. Russia was a big part in the creation of the Balkan Union. But that union was done with these unilateral negotiations. It was no conference that created them. But there was another set of negotiations between Bulgaria and Greece in May of 1912, of course directed against the Turks in the same way. Great Britain had to be involved because they're very worried about, you know, how far they're going to go in destroying Turkey. They were pretty sure that the Russians, the Bulgarians, are not going to take up its debt. Still, at this point, the territorial issues were not resolved. Serbia and Montenegro had essentially a verbal agreement, because Montenegrins and Serbs are the same, just living under different circumstances. But those two had their own agreement with Bulgaria. Now, what's the Macedonian issue? It's a huge problem. Macedonia is a huge region in the Balkans, it overlaps Bulgaria, Serbia, and Greece. the Greeks accepted North Macedonia as a Slavic area. Skopje is its capital. But the rest of it, Southern Macedonia, is historically Greek. It borders the Aegean Sea. Now, a huge number of ethnic Greeks identify themselves as Macedonians. So they're unrelated to the Slavic Macedonians to the north. That's why that became very important. Greece, in more recent years, objected. They hated the idea of using Macedonia for the Slavic entity to the north. Greece accused the North Macedonians of appropriating symbols that were typically Greek. The Virginia Sun, for example, Alexander the Great, seeking a united Macedonia, which would involve territorial claims against Greece, Bulgaria, Albania, and Serbia. Greece, Bulgaria, and Serbia. More importantly, it's to be understood that Bulgaria was uniformly understood to be the leader of this union. It will do most of the fighting. It was the largest entity by far, with the largest army. But the weakness was these bilateral agreements with each of the participants, without being bound to each other. This meant that Bulgaria took huge military commitments on without guaranteeing its political goals. Bulgaria did most of the suffering and dying in the First Balkan War. It paid the most by far. September 1912, the Sultan refused to grant full autonomy to Christians in his Orthodox people, really, in his European possessions, which Bulgaria, Greece, Serbia, and Montenegro had demanded, as might be expected. Great powers. When we say the great powers, we're talking about Britain, France, and Germany. They would rather not be drawn into this prematurely, but it was very difficult to prevent. September 17th, the Balkan Union announced a general mobilization. War was declared October 5th. The Bulgarian army was by far the largest. At their core, about 600,000 men, divided into three armies. And you had a first-rate command, Vasil Kutinchev, Nikola Ivanov, and the very famous Radko Dmitriev. And you had assistant commanders, General Mikhail Savov, and the chief of staff of the army, Ivan Fichev. On top of that, you had thousands of volunteers from Macedonia and elsewhere, eager to take part in the liberation. They started to form their own local militias, which the Bulgarians helped create and encouraged, despite being essentially autonomous. The Macedonian militia, although they usually took the names of the localities where they were from, and they took one of these men, a general from the old militiaman, Nikola Genev, the reserves, who was appointed chief of this. So you had tremendous national enthusiasm. 12 full companies were formed of even just these, I don't want to call them irregulars necessarily, they're more like a national guard. And they usually are named from the cities, from Thrace and Macedonia. Now it was up to 50 companies. Bulgarian patriots, former Chetniks, commanders of various nationalist groups. Many of them were able to operate in the rear of the Turkish army. Attacks, sabotage, intelligence, not to mention protecting the local population from the excesses of the Basibazouks. If you remember from a few months ago, the irregular forces of the Ottoman army that were raised only in times of war. They often were Albanians. And they came from all over, but it was mostly Albanians. Even were slaves from parts of Africa. And they had a good reputation for being undisciplined and brutal, looting and preying on civilians. They were very unregulated. And it was expected they would live off the places that they took, which is always a bad thing. Remember, the Janissaries were long gone. But it didn't mean that Turkey didn't need a shock troops, a shock force anymore. They did. If you want a study of nationalism at its absolute best, the Balkans is where you go. If nations are figments of your imagination, as the left wants to tell you, then so is imperialism. Because the only reason that imperialism is a bad thing is that it prevents other peoples, not related ethnically to the imperial power, from being independent. But the plan was, again, most of this was Bulgarian, but the armies were to advance in two directions, Macedonia and eastern Thrace. Thrace, that section, really, that it's almost a strip, eastern part of it, heading to Istanbul. Turkey maintained several strong fortresses, Lozengrad, Edirne. Macedonia, the Turks weren't there in any real force, but the Serbs and the Greeks were to worry about that. I mean, Edirne was the second capital of Turkey, so this is not a minor place. It was the guard of Istanbul, the advance guard of Istanbul from the north. The Turkish army was slaughtered once the Bulgarians rushed into Thrace. One defeat after another, often without a fight. There was no desire to fight the Bulgarians. Nationalism had created such an enthusiasm. The Turks had the exact opposite. The Bulgarians impressed everyone with a tremendous artillery unit. Very accurate, very disciplined. The Turks abandoned large numbers of cannon, tons of equipment, and the Bulgarians took many prisoners. Edirne is the same as Adrianople, just two different names for the same place. Lozengrad fell without a fight, so really, Istanbul was wide open. Now, the way that the Bulgarian army at the time was organized is strange. Sometimes they used army where they meant division, and division where they meant army. They'd even use the word corps. They weren't done in any kind of regularity at this point. So the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Bulgarian armies were total, 297,000 men. But the large-scale battle was the Edirne defensive line. And it fought up, it went up against the Ottoman East Army, not quite 100,000 men. Another area was the Gallipoli Peninsula, which is directly across from Istanbul. So you're talking about the crossroads of the world here. It's tough to get more strategic. So now, Istanbul was completely exposed. The Ottoman intelligence was terrible. The Turkish intelligence was awful. And any counterattack failed miserably. The Bulgarians shone, they absolutely shone to the world. They were shining. They were at the height of their enthusiasm. Everyone was impressed. So many areas then were abandoned without a fight. Now, the problem with the Adrianople or the Edirne fortress was that Bulgaria wasn't able to get their siege equipment there quickly. So there wasn't really an assault possible, but it probably would have fallen anyway. The Greeks had some navy, actually had naval supremacy in the Aegean, and that kept the Turks from receiving reinforcements. So it was crucial. But regardless, Bulgaria showed itself to the world as capable, autonomously protecting the Orthodox peoples of the Balkans. Serbia, Greece, they were too small to do this alone. Bulgaria was quite the opposite, and they were deeply respected. Now, we really were here to talk about the Second Balkan War that came as a direct result of the first. The Battle of Kilisia. The Bulgarian High Command decided to wait a few days. They needed to rest their forces, but even a short rest allowed the Turks to regroup. So you had the 1st and 3rd armies of the Bulgarians, together roughly 150,000 men, destroyed the now reinforced Ottoman army and reached the Sea of Marmara. That, by the way, was the largest battle fought in Europe from the end of the Franco-Prussian War to the beginning of the First World War. The final defensive line before Constantinople was the Catalca line. You want to talk about panic. The entire empire was, or at least the Turks as an ethnic group together, they were absolutely in a panic state. The Bulgarians couldn't be beaten. But it was often the case, but it couldn't be everywhere. And you know, the Ottomans were able to take people from all over that empire. The Bulgarians did have to take rest periods. Enthusiasm and adrenaline, that could only go so far. And even 24, 48 hours was enough for the Turks to take up new positions in places where, well, today would be the extreme northern part of modern Turkey. Ludaburgaz, Brunahisar, for example, cities in Turkey today. Starting on October 15th, some of the most ferocious battles took place. And of course, the Turks were again defeated. The Turks numbered about 150,000, maybe more, and their retreats were becoming less and less orderly. Now, even the Turkish high command was falling apart. This was a victory for orthodoxy, you know, that in the 20th century had very few analogs. The coalition reached the Sea of Marmara. You could see Constantinople. After fierce fighting, all of Western Thrace was liberated, and at the village of Mermali, Memben Yavrupasha surrendered with about 10,000 men. Now, one of the reasons I say that Bulgaria was powerful enough to be considered almost a great power in its own right, but that it also had a small but well-run navy, as well as an air force, which was a big deal back then. The beyond the Black Sea, Bulgarian navy destroyed the Turks on the water. November 8th, 1912, the Bulgarian torpedo carrier Dratki destroyed a Turkish cruiser, put it out of action. The Turks had no conception of the air war. Bulgarian aviation was doing very well. It's not a very typical topic of conversation, but it carried out very good combat reconnaissance flights. Terrified the Turks. They knew nothing about it. The Western allies were noticing this, though. They were noticing how impressive they were, how large this country was becoming. Nationalism having maintained this enthusiasm, and for good reason. It was a legitimate war against an illegitimate colonial power. It was becoming a great power in its own right. Two great powers, Bulgaria and Russia, that alliance was a nightmare beyond nightmares for the city of London. Now, the Serbs and the Greeks, I don't want to, you know, denigrate anything they did. No one's more Serbian than I am. pro-Serbian than I am, I should say. But they easily overcame the resistance of the Turks and the Vardar River. But end of October, almost nothing. And the Balkans remained in Turkish hands. So what happens when your nation is falling apart? You sue for peace. Grand Vizier Kamil Pasha sent a telegram to Tsar Ferdinand very late September, wanting an armistice. Well, Ferdinand wasn't an idiot. He wasn't going to worry about this. Just like the American Empire now, you know, falling apart, not a great power anymore, but it's the you could lose your superpower status, but the process of losing the mentality of a superpower takes a lot longer. And the Turks were in the same sense. They were acting like they were doing the Bulgarians a favor. We'll give you, you know, what you want. You'll have many favorable conditions. As if they had control over the situation. Rather than take that bait on November 4th, Bulgarian troops attacked the very last line of defense, as I mentioned, the last fortress. Still, it was a problem because that brief period of peace, that fortress was reinforced with men from Asia Minor. And there was another problem. Cholera had broken out amongst the Bulgarians. Finally, the Bulgarians were not successful, although the Turks took massive losses. This is why they had to deal with peace negotiations. The armistice was signed on November 20th. Now, the fact that they were held in London makes, you know, would make anyone nervous. The minute you hear that, you start wondering what's really going on here. London controlled the Turkish Empire because it controlled its economy. And it wasn't just Bulgaria, of course. It was the entire Balkan alliance. They wanted not just, you know, the Balkans, but, you know, the Aegean islands. But that last battle, which was largely determined by cholera, not by Turkish martial excellence, they had very much an unearned confidence, and they rejected the initial proposal. Of course, January 10th, 1913, the Young Turks take over. Then everything changes. This new government had... They were very Masonic, very Judaic. They had a far greater, I'll put it this way, they had very limited resources, but the Young Turks didn't know that. And so negotiations were interrupted. The Young Turks were preparing for an offensive. The Germans already were sending heavy artillery to the Turks via Romania, which was a huge disappointment for everybody. The Turks landed at Buller in Charkov, but they still lost. Unfortunately, the Turks were not able to take Katalka. Still, though, I'm sorry, the Turkish army couldn't retake Katalca. That failed. And the Young Turks were humiliated. They were completely defeated. This is one time where the Bulgarians really did need to rest and regroup. Not only were the Balkans now being divided up amongst the Orthodox, but even the island of Crete was taken, as it should be. The great powers, one of their responses was to create Albania as a way to keep Turkey from accessing the sea. Still, massive, huge territories, large populations were liberated from the feudal empire of the Turks. Turkish empire in Europe was not in any way advanced in the liberal sense. We've talked about that in many different ways. The Orthodox were freed from the national and political oppression. But now, what was left of Turkish influence in the Balkans was from now the Masonic Young Turks. And that made things worse. The only good news was that Bulgaria was growing even faster, not just militarily, but industrially and everything else. Romania played a negative role in this, and it's a shame. Right around the very first Bulgarian successes over the Ottomans, the war broke out. The Romanians made territorial demands on Bulgaria. Now, their argument that there, a Romanian envoy arrives in Sofia on October 21st, 1912, insisting on certain lands, the Turkoton line, for example. They wanted to preserve a balance of power. Well, no, the Bulgarians wanted to lead the area, not have a balance. Balance just means constant warfare. Balance of power is not going to work there. Now, the Bulgarians promised to cede maybe 20 border villages in the very strategic area, southern Dobruja. Dobruja, I should say, and guarantee Romanian rule in the northern part of the region. Discussions were in London, in parallel with peace negotiations between the Balkan League and the Ottoman Empire, but that failed completely. Romania was now receiving support from Austria-Hungary, and it renewed its demands. It wanted more territory. Bulgaria called on Russia for assistance in this respect. The government was run by Geshev, and it rejected these claims. There was a possibility of the Bulgaria-Romania war. But Sofia and Bucharest were forced to accept arbitration from the major European powers, which for Bulgaria wasn't something they wanted to deal with. But their losses, remember, their victories were tremendous, but their losses also were. Something called the Petersburg Protocol was signed. Bulgaria agreed to cede the city of Silistra, we'll get to where that is in a minute, to Romania. Both sides were dissatisfied, as usual for these kind of things. Romanian 5th Corps crossed the border into Dobruja on June 28th. This is now a country not quite as large as Bulgaria, but they hadn't suffered losses in this war. Their whole claim was that we had claimed neutrality. But since the Turks wouldn't trust that, because these were Orthodox people, they had to keep a garrison, a substantial garrison, near that border, allowing the Bulgarians more freedom of action. That was the concept. It's kind of like in the Iraq War, where Saddam Hussein needed to cut his army in half and have many divisions on the border with Turkey. Even though Turkey claimed it wasn't going to do anything, they still didn't trust them. So they had to maintain a large presence there, which affected their ability to repulse the Americans. The Romanians continued to advance, though, supported by the French. One of the reasons that the French supported it is that they realized, along with the British, that Bulgaria cannot be allowed to become the ruler of the Balkans, or at least the leader of the Balkans, not in a formal sense, as, you know, creating a large Bulgaria that dominated everything, but in a leadership role. That can't happen. War became more intensified when Bulgaria refused to give up Dobruja, the southern part of it. Now things are struggling in Bulgaria. They were struggling now. Romania's intervention threatened the Bulgarian Navy. There was a decision, maybe it was a bad one, to scuttle the Danube flotilla, the mouth of the Ruski Lom River, while their Black Sea flotilla, which was impressive, it was sent to neutral territory in Sevastopol, in Crimea. Unfortunately, there it was disarmed, and after the war, The enemy ships were removed from the river. Many of them were depreciated, and many of them were scrapped. Dobruja was immense significance. It lies on the border of Romania and Bulgaria, but also is a tremendous coastal port in the Black Sea. It also was an area with quite a number of Jews. It was a merchant city, Jews, Tartars, Germans, Greeks, and others. So this was a wealthy port city with a lot of cash coming in and out. So it seemed that the Entente had got their wish. They learned that focusing on destroying Russia, even though they were technically in alliance with them, which is nonsensical, they wanted Russia completely destroyed. While they were focused on Russia, they were forgetting about Bulgaria. They were still used to seeing, you know, these Balkan powers as small and irrelevant. Well, that was no longer the case as Bulgaria was rising. That then emboldened the Serbs and the Greeks, to lay claims on those territories that their military presently occupied, regardless whether or not they were ethnically connected to them. So the Greeks wanted to annex Aegean Macedonia. Unfortunately, there was a Bulgarian ethnic majority in the area. The Greeks were taking advantage of the fact that their alliance, the unilateral alliance treaty, did not define these spheres of influence in Macedonia. And the Bulgarians didn't have many military units there. The Greeks were expanding its occupation territory. There was only a handful of Bulgarian garrisons there. There wasn't really a fight. So it wasn't just the British and the French that were worried about Bulgarian strength. Despite the fact that the Bulgarians had done the overwhelming majority of the fighting and the dying in defeating, in the First Balkan War, the Turks, Bulgaria had everything against them now. They wanted an equal portion of the pie. Romania, of course, started all of this. Romania was financed by the French to a great extent. Again, in 1912, they demanded compensation for their neutrality. Again, the Romanians said they were neutral. Turkey needed to divert forces to deal with it if that changed. Yet, as we've already mentioned, the Romanians also permitted weapons, artillery to be delivered to the Turks from Germany. It wasn't a danger of yet another war, which of course did take place. And the Germans, also Hungarians, the British, they kind of liked this idea. They wanted to deepen the contradictions, to finally destroy that alliance, and in the process, destroy Bulgaria. Tsar Ferdinand wanted to preserve the Union. He knew things were going to get worse here. This is one of the reasons that having these German monarchs was a very good thing. They knew people. They knew their family had contacts everywhere. The Serbs were at somewhat of a disadvantage, as wonderful as their monarchs were, Karadjordjevic, Obrenović. They were brand new royal houses. The Germans were not the case. That was not that way. Tsar Ferdinand certainly fought for the interests of Bulgarians. They had the best of both worlds in that regard. So, the Khrushchev government did appeal to Russia to mediate in this dispute with Serbia. The idea of Orthodox people killing each other is repulsive. It was repulsive then, it's repulsive now. Now, the treaty between Bulgaria and Serbia, there was Article 4, which was the secret annex, which permitted Russian arbitration in these disputed areas, especially in the areas of Skopje, Kučevo, Debar, and Struga. These are all important cities along rivers that facilitate trade, and they were all in fertile valleys. Anytime you mention a city that's worth taking, it's either on the Black Sea, on the Aegean, or close to it, or on a river that empties out into one of those places. The Russians, the Russian foreign ministry was under Sergei Sazonov. And he initially wanted the Bulgarians to make these territorial concessions. Gershov refused. I'm not sure if I would have. I probably would have. Sazonov tried to arrange a meeting among the leaders of Bulgaria, Serbia, Greece, and Montenegro in Thessaloniki. That failed. That's unfortunate. Nicholas II then sent a letter to the Bulgarian Tsar and the Serbian monarch at the time was Peter, saying that he is now the arbitrator, and warned both sides from taking up arms again. The Bulgarian government changed. Danov had taken over from Gershov. That was immediately after the conclusion of the Peace of London. He was invited to Petersburg, along with Pašić, very famous leader of the government in Serbia, invited to Petersburg. They accepted the invitation, but since hostilities broke out in Macedonia anyway, that was canceled. All of this comes down to the fear, for various reasons, of Bulgaria's growing power, wealth, military acumen. For the First Balkan War, Bulgaria was largely fighting on its own and showing itself to be a first-rate military power, not necessarily reliant on Russia. It wasn't purely autarkic either, but it had trade relationships elsewhere. The rest of the Balkans wanted to crush the Bulgarian state, and the British and the French helped this happen. They didn't want to intervene directly. They probably couldn't. Bulgaria was never crushed, but the point of the Second Balkan War was precisely to do that. The Bulgarian political military leadership didn't assess this. They didn't grasp this concept. They didn't assess the looming danger the way they should have. They still were under this influence of the early victories, the power of Bulgarian weapons. As this is going on, the Serbs, the Greeks, they're resting, strengthening their positions in Macedonia. They were intensively preparing for war. They concluded a secret treaty for joint struggle against Bulgaria. There was a Serbian, Serbian King Peter issued his manifesto for declaration of war. I think very much influenced from outside. And that was diplomacy to a great extent of the Central Powers, not just the Entente. That means Bulgaria had everything against them. The German Chancellor, Bertman Hollweg, said, "No one knows how the war between Serbia and Bulgaria will end, but one thing will be a fact. Whoever emerges victorious in this war, the two peoples will weaken and hate each other as a result." But the Bulgarians were not ready for another war. The First Balkan War had deeply weakened its military forces. It had completely destroyed what used to be a great power, and maybe still be could still be considered one. And it had tremendous casualties. Now, there was no plan in the high command for a war with Greece or Serbia. It almost seemed out of the question to them. So they didn't gather their forces in one place. The forces were scattered all over the place, from Vidin to Thessaloniki, maintaining their new possessions. Because they had no understanding of this, they were not ready for this. But even if they were ready for this, they didn't think it would happen. And the Russians did not help, unfortunately. The Russians declared that Bulgaria would bear all the responsibility for any war that occurs. The Danev government, by the end of May, replaced that, as I mentioned, Ivan Gershkov, ordered the cessation of hostilities, but it was too late by that point. And then, Romania declared war on Bulgaria on June 28th, 1913. The Romanian army captured much of northern Bulgaria, right up to the Sofia Plain. It was predatory. Turkey, now having recovered to some extent in late June of 1913, tried to retake some of the Balkans, which it did for a time. Its troops crossed the new border that was established by the London Peace Treaty and went after Thrace. The Turks took their revenge on the civilian population in these areas because they did not have army protection anymore. They were massacred. This is a national contest. Bulgaria went from the cusp of great power status to now in the midst of a catastrophe. Its peoples were slaughtered by the Turks when they took over that area of Thrace. And, you know, its army hadn't suffered a defeat on the battlefield yet. A new government. Now, you had three governments in less than a year. This time it was Prime Minister Vasily Bratislavov, who was very suspicious of Russia, called to power by Ferdinand in 1913. And the Balkan states concluded a peace treaty late July in Bucharest. The very fact that it was in Bucharest matters. Bucharest, the Bulgarian allies from the Balkan War, Romania, plundered these formerly Bulgarian areas. Serbia took Vardar, Macedonia. Greece did the same in Aegean Macedonia. A million Bulgarians remained on territories occupied by either Serbian or Greek troops. Bulgarians, thanks to the Exarchate, which I've dealt with many times in the past, had built up probably the best educational and ecclesiastical system. It fully understood what autocephaly meant and had built up their educational system as a result. It was destroyed. Now, these other powers didn't slaughter people like the Turks did, but you had clergymen and teachers who were sent to prison for a couple of months under harsh conditions. Making matters worse, you had tens of thousands of refugees sought protection in Bulgaria proper. Well, Bulgaria and Turkey had to conclude a separate peace treaty. The Turkish government legalized its reoccupation of eastern Thrace. And it wasn't enough that they had defeated, their gains in the first war were now gone in certain areas, but the Turks then razed to the ground everything the Bulgarians had done to improve the area. Romania took southern Dobruja, vast territory. It pushed its border even 20 miles farther than its initial demands. Bulgaria itself, its military forces lost more than 66,000 men in combat. Now its economy was struggling. By this time, though, had the Western powers not encouraged these Orthodox states, who should have known better, to act like predators, now had a dilapidated economy. It should have been a great power in its own right by now. Many people blamed Ferdinand. Maybe he went too far. Ivan Gershkov, who called what was done on this time a criminal madness. So up until that date, the Bulgarians had the self-confidence of the people destroying colonialism. They were most certainly in the right, morally and every other way. From 1885, they were by far the strongest state in the Balkans. It was called the Bulgarian Miracle, and the Exarchate was a huge part of it, both in education and church structure. This catastrophe damaged this severely. So, you know, you could tell what's going on here. The Balkan League fell out among themselves over the distribution of the spoils of war. If there's something you call it a shame, this is a shame. And the powers involved should be ashamed. But the center of the disagreement was what should be done with Macedonia among the three peoples that are present there, Greeks, Serbs, and Bulgarians. Now, Serbia and Bulgaria already had a pact determining the split, but now that Albania was created, kind of artificially, by the Austrians, Serbia already had taken northern Macedonia, that arrangement was no longer relevant. So, Serbia emerged as the biggest winner. There's nothing wrong with Serbia ever being a winner of anything. It was backed by French financing, and it had become the most powerful of the Balkan states. Its territories grew by 80%, its population by almost 2 million. Now, as you know, I have a book on Serbia. It doesn't really deal with this much. It's mostly a medieval book. But the Bulgarians always had a tendency and had the national spirit to create a substantial empire, to unify the area. Some place like Yugoslavia would not have been necessary if Bulgaria was allowed to develop the way it should have. Of course, the biggest loser of all of this was Bulgaria itself, which lost greatly in terms of men and territory. The worst part of it was that Turkey retook certain areas. Romania took a lot of Bulgaria's recently won territory, as I mentioned in Dobruja. Now, clearly, the impact on the coming First World War is significant, but that's really not my concern. Both Balkan wars had sown seeds of resentment and seeds of hope throughout the area. Bulgaria had rebuilt several times before this, and they'll do so again. But there's one thing it did do. Situation reminded every Balkan state was aware of how fragile any gain or loss that they had was. They were well aware of their economic and military exhaustion. Nobody wanted any further war. Now, when someone tries to claim that the murder of Franz Ferdinand by young Bosnia was a Serb somehow seeking war, it's laughable. The last thing in the world the Serbs wanted at this point was war. These powers were completely exhausted. But they also knew that diplomacy would prove just as much decisive as military strength. The Russians had gone so far as to say that if the Bulgarians occupied Constantinople, the Russians would quite possibly cut off their supplies. It was stated on November 17, 1912, when the Katalka line battle began. We're going back another year here. The Balkan War was strange in that Russia was a little bit worried about what Bulgaria was becoming. I don't believe it had any reason to believe that. It didn't need to be a subject of Russia or even be influenced by it. The biggest division in Bulgarian politics was pro-Russia or anti-Russia. You know, liberals, you know, in a very big quotes, were anti-Russian. Bulgarians did regroup. But Constantinople was wide open to the Bulgarians, but they did not take the city for many reasons. one of which was that the Russians would have been upset if that was the case. One of the biggest events was the Young Turk coup taking place. As the First Balkan War came to an end, Bulgaria was at the height of its power. It was a tremendous distraction. Any negotiations were very quickly disrupted in London. It set, unfortunately, Bulgaria and Serbia at odds. There's a reason why Bulgaria was not a part of Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was the result of Bulgaria being almost destroyed at the end of the Second Balkan War. Yugoslavia made a certain amount of sense in that, especially with predatory Italy, predatory Turkey, even to some extent Hungary. Individually, including, you know, artificially, Bulgaria should have been able to handle it no problem, but the Balkan countries were too small in and of themselves to fight back. Needless to say, the Hungarians and the Italians were vehemently opposed to the creation of Yugoslavia. But the only reason it ever came into existence is that Bulgaria had been so badly damaged. And all of this, the defeat of the Ottomans, was paid for in blood by overwhelmingly the Bulgarians. Everyone else, and they did their part. The Romanians didn't do anything. But the Serbs and the Greeks, while doing their part, didn't bleed nearly as much as the Bulgarians did. Again, no one's more pro-Serbian than I am. But in this case, they were simply wrong. Bulgaria was in the right here. Accepting Bulgarian leadership didn't mean the utter domination. It wouldn't have been like a Bulgarian version of Yugoslavia. It wouldn't have been like that. So the Second Balkan War was an utter disaster, not just for Bulgaria, but for Orthodoxy in general. Orthodox people were killing each other. It should have simply been a Balkan alliance led by Bulgaria making war on Islam, whether Albanian or Turkish. Now the Bulgarians had to concentrate their forces against Serbia, which in and of itself is tragic and a shame. The Bulgarian army in the Second War was outnumbered by the Greek forces. The fiercest battles took place then, the town of Kilkis, and the Greeks won. Bulgarians now are cut off from the Aegean Sea, even part of the Southern Balkans now. The Serbs and the Bulgarians clashed. A stalemate. You had, you know, Bulgarians winning in the north, the Serbs winning in the south. And it was a draw at this point. So King Constantine of Greece thought it was his job to finish this, pushing the Bulgarians even farther back. Everyone just became more and more exhausted, and the casualties rose and rose for only Machiavellian reasons. Romania was working with a revitalized Ottoman Empire, with a young Turk or Ottoman, it didn't matter. Because of the battles with the Greeks and the Serbs and their total exhaustion, Bulgarians really couldn't resist. As the Romanians headed straight towards Sofia, the capital of Bulgaria. So you're talking about like 10 months. The political and diplomatic state of the Balkans had changed, to say drastically is not powerful enough. It should have been so simple. A solid league of Orthodox nations taking Europe back from the Ottomans resulted in the bitterly divided region that we know today. And the Western powers had everything to do with this. While it seemed to be clear from the start that Bulgaria would gain the most from the alliances of subsequent wars, they were surpassed now by Serbia. But after World War I, they realized that they couldn't run this on their own. Bulgaria was in that position before it was attacked. Geshov, one of the prime ministers of Bulgaria, wrote two books, quite pompous ones, The Criminal Madness and the Inquiry into It, which came out in 1914, and The Balkan Union, which came out a year later. These are mostly polemical works defending himself. He led the government from March 16, 1911 to May 27, 1913. And he had to defend one conception. How could an army be mobilized for the Second War, 570,000 men, experience such a humiliating defeat? To the point where Romania was almost taken. I'm sorry, Sofia was almost taken by the Romanians. Where were these men? Substantial loans, 65 million francs from the French to Bulgaria, connected now Sofia with the French in a way that they didn't like. The finance minister, Todorov. Turns out that Ivan Geshov and his deputy, Tudor Todorov, agreed to divide Macedonia behind the backs of the Bulgarians, waiting for the arbitration of the Russian monarch in a disputed zone. Problem is, the corruption was deeper than we had initially thought. Article 2 of the secret annex of the Treaty of Friendship and Alliance between Bulgaria and Serbia, as I said that two parties undertake to accept as a final border that line which His Majesty the Russian Tsar, within the above-mentioned borders, would find it best to meet the rights and interests of both parties. That was the conception. But that was secret. It hadn't been published anywhere, because if it was published, Geshev government would have been overthrown. In that form, no one would have publicly signed that. The fact that the army was so scattered, having only a token a presence in some very significant areas, that's the only reason that the Serbs were able to win so many victories early on. There's a lot of questions that need to be answered. How can this possibly be? And what did these battlefield defeats had to do with the hollowing out of the economy? Bulgaria, at some point, was a creditor nation. How did it suddenly become a debtor nation? The Balkan Wars were unique. Or at least they were very rare, in the sense that the army of one country, that is Bulgaria, was ultimately used for the full implementation of the national unifying purposes of its neighbors, Serbia and Greece. The first gain that Bulgaria had from the Balkan War was the secession of Silistria, which was on the Danube, to Romania in the Second Balkan War, April 26, 1913. Of course, the legislation knew nothing about this. It was in violation of the Constitution. It was deception. The government, not necessarily the monarch, the governments, which had come and gone, three governments in, I think, 10 months, functioned very Machiavellian-like. On the diplomatic front and in military operations, the defeated Turks were never pursued. In fact, General Dmitriev was ordered to stop the offensive for 2 days. This is back in 1912. If Istanbul was ripe for the taking, why wasn't it taken? And why was Russia so concerned with the Bulgarians taking it? Why wasn't General Dmitriev, the hero of Bulgaria, simply ordered into Istanbul Of course, we would have had a very quick separate peace with the Turkish Empire. We would have been out of the war at that point. The army was prepared for a quick war against the Ottomans, but how was that decided? As much as the Bulgarians had gained tremendously economically, the Bulgarian economy was not ready for prolonged hostilities. Yet somehow it fought for 3 years on two fronts successfully in World War I. Even the equipment. Allegedly, there were shortages all over the place, but we have, Gershov actually shows in his book, Criminal Madness and the Survey on it, he talks about shortages before the wars, and yet the procurement had, things like, they struggled with, jackets and overcoats and trousers, 100,000 of them, 130 overcoats, 135,000 trousers, 145,000 caps, 85,000 boots. He says he overcame this deficit very quickly, and yet they were dying of frostbite in eastern Thrace. And where did the cholera come from? And why did no other force have this problem? And why was it necessary to take money from the French? And even though these deficits and all those supplies were overcome, why was the front consistently in a critical state? Wasn't just cholera, it was smallpox too, by the way. General Ivan Fichtsev mentioned that. He says he wanted a 20-day rest period because, quote, the terrible psychological impact of the cholera epidemic and smallpox has struck the morale of our troops beyond recognition, and the inability to organize the proper supply of food supplies and fodder significantly contributes to the deterioration of sanitary conditions and the decrease in the combat ability of the army. Because in a short time, we risk being left without horses or livestock. This is a very strange admission. 9 days before the armistice. How come that didn't happen during World War I? Again, Bulgarian army fought for 3 whole years. People blame Tsar Ferdinand for the peace treaty of Bucharest, but he wasn't there. The only person who was there was Deputy Chief of Staff Ivan Fichtsev. Somehow, the Gershov government told the military that the only place the army could be used successfully is at Edirne. The Tsar got so angry that he almost forced Gershov's resignation. The same man did not read the report from the Southern Front. Deliberately made himself ignorant about the movement of the Greek army as the Greeks surrounded in Kresna Gorge. The other term that they use for the Second Balkan War is the Inter-Allied War. The fact is that there is no written order from the Tsar to initiate military action against Serbia. The only order came from General Michael Savov. He was the only one who, by himself, attacked the Serbian forces. Bulgarian diplomacy wasted an entire year, 1911-1912. The Serbian and Greek monarchs had already coordinated their actions for war against Bulgaria. The massacres of the Bulgarians, once the Turks retook some of these places in eastern Thrace, was a massive scandal. How can that possibly be? The Bulgarian government's response to the Central Powers was granted October 1st, 1915. Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey, yes, they agreed to join against Serbia, Greece, Romania, and Russia. They were able to retake the Moravian Valley, much of Macedonia, the Ruja, returned to Bulgaria by 1917. But of course, they were lost very quickly afterwards. There was a tremendous corruption with what could have been the leader of the Orthodox in the Balkans. And it seems to go back to Gershov. Why was the army not present in these areas where the massacres took place? Why were there only token resistance? Small units left in these places. You had a huge army to work with. They shouldn't have been defeated anywhere. But the goal was a liquidation of Bulgaria under Russian dictation. Now, we're talking a bit later on. This is prior to the Russian Revolution. Finally, 1913, bankruptcy of the governments of Stoyan Donev. There was a third government, as I mentioned, Vyacheslavov, finally pulling Bulgaria out of the abyss, signing these terrible peace treaties. But he also told the world that as far as Bulgaria is concerned, collaboration with Serbia, Greece, or Russia in the future was absolutely impossible. Now, Geshev and Donov were not just making errors, but there was a tremendous amount of corruption behind them. But, of course, they had parliamentary immunity at the time. After World War I, were they finally tried? Rightly or wrongly, the law on trying those responsible for the national catastrophe came in 1923. And the men responsible, the so-called Russophiles, were sent to prison for a short time. The truth is that all of this is based on the desire for Bulgaria to be destroyed as an emerging great power, in union with Russia or even without. During the First Balkan War, Bulgaria had all the ingredients, an air force, a navy, a seasoned civil service, a diplomatic corps, a growing industrial economy, and a desire to lead the Balkans to victory against the Turks, and a very competent monarch. But as far as the great powers were concerned, that obsession to get the Russians and Germans to fight one another, Bulgaria kind of fell through the cracks. It took a while for the West to see Bulgaria for what it was. But the First Balkan War, her victories couldn't be denied. Something had to be done. So by the end of the Second Balkan War, Bulgaria had been tamed. I tried to, you know, give a, some outline of the mechanics here. The idea that's based on the anti-Russian and anti-Orthodox mentality of the great powers, especially Britain. See, some of the treaties, unilateral treaties, held that all land was to be held in common until Turkey was finished, until they were driven out completely. The territory north of the Shar mountain range, Novi Bazar, you know, the Sanjaks of old Serbia, that was to go to Serbia. Territory east, south and east of the Rhoda mountain range and Sturma River went to Bulgaria. The intermediate region was given full autonomy. Even if parties should agree that autonomy was not feasible, it was to be divided between them according to the lines defined in the treaty. There was no reason for what happened to Bulgaria. The Tsar's arbitrator turned out to be a terrible idea. That was not to be. French-British financing led to these basic plain provisions of these agreements to be overridden once the Second Balkan War was over. It crushed the Balkans, crushed Bulgaria almost completely, and rendered the Balkans completely without a leader. It was a shame, and it was a crime. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.